This is Barbara Glickstein, and you're tuned into HealthCetera. HealthCetera is produced by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. Yue Chu is the founder, president, and CEO of the Academy of Medical and Public Health Services in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. He's also a Mahoney Fellow at the New York Academy of Medicine, where we first met. I want to read the mission statement directly from their document about the Academy of Medical and Public Health Services for its unique languaging and also the work that its statement of the work that they do. And I quote, AMPHS is a humanitarian nonprofit organization operated solely by volunteers and dedicated to advancing the health care of underprivileged communities in Brooklyn. We accomplish our goals by providing free and low-cost community activities that forge a firm foundation for the improvement of health and well-being, end quote. There's also a beautiful vision statement, and I would direct you to their website to find out more about that. But let's talk to the founder and president and CEO of the Academy of Medical and Public Health Services, Mr. Yue Chu. Welcome to HealthCetera.
Thanks, Barbara. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
You have a vision, and you have been living and building this vision now for 5 years, having just celebrated your fifth anniversary recently.
Yeah.
I'd love for you to take our listeners through the path of why this place, why this specific vision of serving a community in Brooklyn of people who are often not ones who want, many people care about, but many people don't actually build something with such a vision and then deliver and create that vision. So tell us about your path to discovery of making this all happen.
Sure. You know, it started 5 years ago, and it actually started longer than 5 years ago. So about 6 or 7 years ago, I had lost my mother to cancer. And it was a very difficult and challenging and testing time for me, you know, because sort of like, you know, just imagine if you're going home and one day, you know, you were told, all right, you only have 6 months left together. I mean, you know, what was I to think and what was I to do? And even just going through the treatment with her, going through the chemotherapy sessions, having met other individuals who are suffering from a similar disease and sort of seeing that challenge and personally feeling that challenge, I sort of thought to myself, wow, if this is so difficult for me, I can't possibly imagine how it must be like for the many hundreds of thousands out there who are suffering from similar or, more severe chronic conditions, but they are not able to get the care that they need. And I soon came to realize that equitable healthcare access in itself is a disparity. And so if we're able to start pooling together all the different resources that we have available in our community and launch a community-driven, grassroots-based program initiative to help start to tackle this disparity of equitable healthcare access, then maybe we can start making a real difference in the care that, you know, these vulnerable populations need.
Well, first I want to acknowledge that in the memory, the beautiful memory of your mother, that this is seed was planted out of her death and your loss of having lost your mother at an early age. What an honor that you have bestowed on her and your family in taking that situation and creating the Academy of Medical and Public Health Services and recognizing that this can be addressed. You know, one of my heroes and sheroes is a nurse midwife named Ruth Lubick, who says, just because you're poor doesn't mean you can't be healthy. And she's has created birthing centers, which we can talk about at another time. But I think this idea that being poor means that you are not going to be healthy is one that needs to constantly be corrected as a myth and an error. And I think your work is a tribute to that mission as well. So you have this idea. You were, I know, were in graduate school while you launched this idea, and only in 5 years have. Tell us about what the community that you're serving, and what sort of goes on when you have, what's a day like at the clinic?
Sure. So we are located in Sunset Park, and Sunset Park is a very diverse, very interesting neighborhood because it's just at the intersection of the Hispanic, Latino, and the Asian populations. And so we sort of see, you know, how cultural beliefs and different ethnicities play into the healthcare and the manifestations of conditions and diseases of these populations. You know, when we first started, we were surprised because we had individuals coming to us telling us that they haven't seen any healthcare provider. One woman, for example, for 60 years. That is, you know, like over half a century. And that just completely, we couldn't believe that. And so it's because of, you know, these unique circumstances that poses also a challenge for us in appropriately serving this population, among, you know, many other challenges. So, yep.
No, go ahead.
Yep. So, you know, when individuals come in, the first thing that we have to do is we have to welcome them warmly into, you know, our center. And we sort of explain to them and sort of hold their hand through what it means to be accessing healthcare. What is each step that they're going to go through, from signing the consent and waiver to visiting the clinician to following up after the clinical visit with a social work visit. So they really have an understanding of what to expect, the proper questions to ask, and you know, what to look out for throughout their entire visit.
So this amazing community, this of rich diversity of individuals and families, give us a sense of where they come from, both newly arrived immigrants to the United States, as well as people who've probably been here for a number of years working and raising their children. Give us a sense of where they come from.
Sure. So they come from various different parts of the world. We have some from South America, we have some from Central America, we have some from Asia, and, you know, various countries within each of those continents.
That's requires then having translation services for those who English is not being their first language, and healthcare being critical, healthcare delivery and understanding of your families and individuals that come, that they are understood. So how do you manage that much translation capacity?
Well, you know, one thing is that we have a tremendously dedicated team of mainly volunteers, and we have very talented volunteers who help with the translation. We have some bilingual staff, of course, for example, Spanish and English, Chinese and English. We even have volunteers who are trilingual, who speak fluently Chinese, Spanish, and English. And so we are able to sort of advocate for each individual by understanding their cultural background, by where they you know, are coming from, by understanding their inherent cultural beliefs, and as well as being able to translate for them and understand, you know, from a language, linguistic point of view as well.
So let's talk about these amazing volunteers. I'm so moved that this much of what happens gets done because of a well-trained volunteer staff. Can you talk about the level of commitment and how people become engaged, and then the program of orientation that you must have in order to make this work so beautifully?
Absolutely. So, you know, our volunteers are extremely dedicated, but also come from very diverse backgrounds. They represent the community that we serve. So they are ethnically diverse, but they are also diverse in terms of their experience. So not all of them comes from a healthcare background, which we think creates the unique culture of our organization. And so because not all of them come from that healthcare background, our orientation and the initial onboarding process is tailored to their specific expertise, their interests, and their passion for volunteering. So prior to each orientation, we sit down with our volunteers to learn about what drew them initially to our organization. In management theory, there's a term called the valence of a staff member, and that basically is, what is that initial attraction? Why are they drawn to the organization? So we really try to play up that valence of why a staff member wants to come to our organization. Once we have an idea of why everyone is interested in joining and volunteering for us, we then are able to put together a more customized, personalized orientation program so that, during the orientation, yes, we cover, our mission statement, our vision statement, our core values, but then we also have more specific breakout groups into what we call functional groups, where volunteers can learn more about the specific role that they're serving and discuss with each other what was their passion for coming into the organization and how can they attach that passion to the role that they will be playing within our organization.
And the level of thought as well as the amount of investment of time on the part of the AMPHS and the volunteer really sounds to me foundational to reducing the amount of attrition where volunteers feel like they're not really valued or it's boring or I didn't come here to do that. And you're building community as a network web that I think is an incredibly valuable part of your of the center that you are working with.
Oh, absolutely. And we constantly think about that and, how that comes into play in developing the culture that, we want to be able to display that helps to draw the volunteers in closer. As just an example, even sort of the terminology that we use within the organization. For example, the term immigrant today is very stigmatized, right, by the general public, and especially in our current political landscape. And so, while we are not in the business of determining, who is rightfully here in this country or not, we are in the business of ensuring our public's health. And so to do that, we understand, and our volunteer team, understands that we need to look outside of that label, of labeling the person as an immigrant. Because at the end of the day, we are sort of all immigrants when you think about it, right? We could be first generation, second generation, and so forth. But rather, the individuals that we serve, they are our neighbors and they're members of a community. So within the organization, all of our volunteers call the clients that we serve community members because, at the end of the day, we are trying to show respect for those that we are serving. We, don't refer to them as immigrants or not even as patients. And we try to make them feel included as a true part of the community. And so that's just like one minute detail, but it's sort of these little cultural values that sort of allow our volunteers to see the uniqueness in the organization.
My guest is Yuit Chu, who is the founder, president, and CEO of the Academy of Medical and Public Health Services in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. He's also a Mahoney Fellow at the New York Academy of Medicine. And we're talking about the Academy of Medical and Public Health Services that has a very unique and very grounded model that I wanted our community and the community to hear about. So there are many services that you provide, and you talk about that it's both a medical and public health service. So explain why it's public health service in addition to medical, and what aspect of the clinic is a public health service?
Yeah, Barbara, it's interesting because when we think about the healthcare system today, we mainly think about individuals accessing interfacing with the providers and accessing the care they need when they're actually sick. Normally, when you're not sick, you probably wouldn't be in a hospital or, pay your doctor a visit. And so in that sense, I would argue that what we call the healthcare system today really isn't a healthcare system, but more of a disease care system. Now, while we recognize the importance of direct clinical care, we also want to think about it from the perspective of, what is the root cause of having certain conditions manifest themselves in individuals? How can we prevent individuals from having to access, much costly or much more stressful treatments later on? And so in this regard, we are thinking about how can we serve to maintain the public's health. And so that's why we call ourselves both a medical and a public health service. And in order to do this, we think about how can we create interventions that can empower individuals to better understand what health and wellness means in their everyday lives so that they can truly maintain a certain quality of life and not have to access that clinical care.
And I know that one of the other very strong web in the community that you have worked to develop and continue to develop is your resource directory and partnerships. None of us work alone, and certainly as you're building your community, part of that community are some of the other not-for-profits as well as advocacy services that you help to direct the community members to. How has that been, and how well received has it been in building this community outreach for the center?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely challenging because as a young nonprofit organization, when we try to approach the more established, well-known organizations, of course, they haven't heard about us before. They're not aware of our services. So, you know, I would say that the challenge has been threefold. The first is when we approach these organizations, we have to explain to them that, you know, we're not really competing with you, but we are complementing and supplementing the services that are already available in the community, the wonderful services that you already are offering to our community. What we're doing is, you know, maybe you have excess capacity right now, or you have unfilled capacity in the services that you're offering. On the flip side, there are also a lot of individuals in our community who need these services, but they just don't know where to go. Or, you know, let's say, for example, they're afraid of walking into a big looming hospital building. We are more of a grassroots-friendly community organization, and so we are able to bridge that gap between the individuals who need the care and helping direct these individuals to the current services and capacity available in the community. So I would say that's how we overcome the first challenge. The second challenge, of course, is interfacing directly with the community members so that they're able to actually utilize these services and these partnerships that we are forming in our resource directory. Gaining faith and trust in the community, especially in a high-risk, vulnerable, immigrant population, it's fairly challenging because there's this inherent belief that there are always strings attached when offering services to the disadvantaged population. And, you know, we found out pretty early that it's hard to sell free stuff. I would say the third challenge is also ensuring that we're able to, provide our services and have a network of services that are being delivered with high quality in the most effective and efficient manner possible. And of course, you know, that would involve applying well-established practices from business management and operations engineering and process re-engineering to, you know, constantly improve quality standards, improve our own workflow when we do referrals and work with, you know, other partners, and really to cut down the waste on the valuable resources that we have as a nonprofit. And when we do that, you know, that's actually pretty difficult when we're working in a system that inherently has high variances because we're not just manufacturing, like, you know, widgets, for example, right, at a rate of widgets per hour. But at the end of our processes, our outputs are, they're actual human beings, right? They're you and me. So we need to figure out how to best adapt to the individual and adapt to the personalized needs of our unique community members in order to achieve a higher quality impact on their lives rather than just increase in quantity of program outputs. And so it's sort of this principle that drives us to create strong resource networks within our community.
Mm. Well, these areas that you have identified, it sounds to me very much like part of your strategic plans going forward, as well as serious analyses of where you've been and where you want to go. So credit to all of you who are working in such a thoughtful way. One comment that I wanted to reflect on in the area where you discuss trust and building that trust. And although it may sound counterintuitive that when something's offered for free, that people are still hesitant to come and the lines aren't down the block every time you run a clinic session. And certainly we know historically that people in communities, and particularly in communities of color, that there's been a historical mistrust that's based on some very terrible incidences that have happened where people have been used unknowing to themselves in research, and often harm was done. I think trust in general, it's been written about and certainly being spoken about in healthcare, has become quite complex and difficult, and rebuilding that kind of trust does require the kind of diligence that I hear you are putting in to build that trust as well as that community. So one of the things that I would like for you to talk about as well, and I know that you're very interested in policy, and your both your graduate degree as well as your interest in following the current political landscape, have to do with some current reforms, and the DSRIT reforms in New York State will have an impact on an organization like you as well as other not-for-profits. So what is that, and what will the impact be?
Absolutely. You know, health reform in New York State is very ambitious, you know, to say the least. This $7 billion Medicaid redesign that we call DSRIP, which is the Delivery System Reform Incentive Payment Program, calls for a true integration of community healthcare assets in a cost-effective and a coordinated fashion that is really driven by value over volume. And so what that basically means is that the focus is shifting away from a traditional fee-for-service financing, where providers are reimbursed based on the quantity of services performed, into a value-based purchasing agreement where payments are based on clinical outcomes. And, I mean, at the end of the day, the goal of DSRIP is to really reduce hospital readmission rates by 25% over 5 years. Now, there is a higher disparity in clinical outcomes in high-risk, vulnerable immigrant populations. I mean, these individuals are, you know, more at risk for inappropriately utilizing healthcare and visiting the emergency department more often for conditions that should have been treated in a more cost-effective setting. You know, or maybe they could have conditions that should have been prevented in the first place. So community-based organizations and like other grassroots service agencies are probably best positioned to understand the unique and personalized needs of these communities, as they are the ones who've developed the expertise over the years to interact with this population. So, you know, there is a great potential to make a difference for, especially for our Medicaid and Medicaid-eligible population. You know, organizations like us, community-based organizations themselves, they need to constantly be proactive about, you know, how can they integrate themselves with the larger hospital systems, because at least in New York City here, DSRIP is really driven by larger hospital systems. You know, there, and also it would be wonderful. It is a very complex, you know, implementation right now. So, you know, just moving forward, it would be just absolutely wonderful if there is sort of like greater widespread acknowledgement from the state as well to formally include community-based organizations as part of the DSRIP implementation process. Because now many community-based organizations, including us, you know, we're just waiting to see what the hospital systems have planned for us. But at the same time, many hospital administrators haven't yet figured out how to best engage community-based organizations.
And what we saw, what we are seeing certainly in New York City, as you've mentioned, is the purchasing of a lot of private practices in order to have an outpatient presence and to begin to look at how to capture more and more people in community. But those networks have been often initially anyway through private practice, and what you're suggesting or what you're saying is that there are community-based organizations serving ways that you are and similar kinds of ways in communities that hospitals haven't yet been engaging where that has to happen.
Yes, absolutely, because community-based organizations, you know, have that certain depth of expertise and already have that certain level of exposure in the community. There's also that trust factor that's already built into community-based organizations. You know, if someone has been going to a particular community center, community facility for a while, especially in the immigrant population, you know, they already know the individuals there. They already trust that entire community. They're part of that culture within that community-based organization, right? Versus thinking about, you know, an immigrant walking into, again, like this looming large hospital system and whether they would feel more comfortable there versus community-based organization. So there are just certain inherent values and inherent aspects of a community-based organization that would be rather difficult to replicate by a hospital system.
Well, we also know that there the discussions include this idea of population health, this idea that what are the issues, what are the main issues in your catchment area, and how are you defining that area that you serve when we have a tremendous amount of systems that are collapsing into two or three large systems here now in New York City. We can name them or not. And certainly, you know, we have the historical benefit of the Health and Hospitals Corporation, which has been in communities and serving communities that other of the nonprofit and private institutions have not been seeking as their community-based population, and so we're seeing some of the some interesting movement going on around who is the community and how do we define our communities and how hospitals are doing that as well, and yet. We'll see where the funding starts flowing and hopefully more into organizations like yours. I'm talking with Yuet Chu, who's the founder, president, and CEO of the Academy of Medical and Public Health Services. He's also a Mahoney Fellow at the New York Academy of Medicine. So what's next? Where's the big vision continuing to grow in the direction of your dreams and what you see happening? You can choose the amount of years that you've set your goals for, but I want to hear what you're thinking of next, Yuet.
The goal is to one day develop a truly culturally sensitive, linguistically competent, community-based, integrated healthcare delivery system.
That's a mouthful, but I love the way it sounds.
And, you know, what that means, you know, aside from being a mouthful, is that, you know, and you know, of course, we're not the first ones to do so. I mean, as we just talked about, you know, DSRIP, the state is also trying to do the same thing. And, of course, in New York City, through DSRIP, it's mainly hospital-driven. But, you know, what that means is that we're really thinking about it from a community standpoint, from that community population health point of view. We're thinking about it from being able to coordinate comprehensive wraparound social, legal, but behavioral, dental, and medical services along with community education and health literacy, because we still want to emphasize the importance of that public health aspect rather than clinical care. So, you know, being able to develop that network of functionally and structurally integrated community providers who align their priorities, who work from the same platform, who serve the same community, and who are able to keep the care within that community where the population is most comfortable. And I'll also just briefly add in, you know, one other point, and that is that, you know, the other side of that is that there are the community members themselves. So being able to truly empower them so that they feel welcome to join a broader dialogue of what it means to reduce the disparity in healthcare access for their community, you know, making them feel comfortable accessing care when they need to at the appropriate time and in the appropriate setting. And after the care, perhaps more importantly, after they actually access the care, having them be able to continue the conversation with us beyond just in a clinical service context, but more so in a larger preventative health and wellness context.
Well, I want to suggest that we all are aware of terminology that's used to market a program and then what's authentically happening. And how many times community members are very aware of what might look like fancy language in a pamphlet is not delivered when they enter through that service. And it could be any number of things, in particular, healthcare. I've been a nurse for a long time, and a lot of language has been sort of co-opted of what was started as a truly authentic idea and theory that didn't necessarily always get operationalized. It seems to me, Hewitt, that in addition to building this core team of clinical staff and volunteers who come from this community, as well as those who are coming to the care being holding you to that accountability, that this may be stronger than just what may appear as language. How would you defend that as being true?
Well, I would say that, you know, more so than the language itself, being holding ourselves true to our values and our principles, I think it's extremely important, you know, from sort of a leadership standpoint, to periodically review, you know, who are we as an organization? What are our core values? What do we believe in when we say, for example, culturally sensitive? What does that actually mean? Are we just writing that down, you know, as you mentioned in the pamphlet, or are we actually practicing it? Do we have certain policies and procedures in place? Do we have certain activities in place? Do we have resources dedicated to defining cultural sensitivity within our organization, linguistically competent, you know? What does that actually mean? And then also thinking about it from the patient's perspective, or as we call it, the community member's perspective. So thinking about in their shoes when they walk through the door, what is their experience like? If I were to look at our facility through their eyes, would I feel truly welcomed? Would I feel comfortable? Would I feel at ease talking and explaining my problems and, you know, my deepest concerns to a complete stranger? Do I feel comfortable referring my family and friends here? And so I completely agree with you, Barbara, that, you know, we need to look beyond just the language, but explore deeper the actual values that we uphold as an organization.
And since you have this sort of self-evaluation and reflection process, let's bring it to a real life experience, since we all realize that we bring our biases to our practices. We bring our biases to our neighbors and our friends at times. And is there a way, in a very day-to-day practical way, that you help each other, remind each other that you might want to say that a different way, or you may want to approach that person who's from a different culture where that behavior may feel not as welcoming as approaching it this way? How do you do that so people are not then retracting from being their compassionate self, but also recognizing they too are learning to be in this world in a more present relationship way?
I think we could do that through, you know, two ways that act hand in hand together. The first is, of course, initial training for our staff members. So having that cultural sensitivity training, making sure that individuals understand what certain cultural practices are. For example, maybe individuals don't like shaking hands in certain cultures. Maybe individuals, or for example, the elderly population, are a little hesitant when you try to approach them, and, you know, or put your hand on their shoulder. Maybe they're just not comfortable with that. So the initial portion of ensuring this sort of culture, it's just the dissemination of information and making sure that staff are aware of these practices. The second is sort of periodic reminders through briefings, so pre-shift briefings and then post-shift debriefings. Before we start every clinic, we have an all-staff briefing where we cover certain policies and protocols, procedures, different services that are being offered that day, maybe any particular, you know, cases that we should be aware of. But at the end of every briefing, we always have a reminder about what are we doing and why are we doing this. You know, most of us are all here, you know, volunteering our time. We're passionate about public health and, you know, serving those who are underserved. And so, you know, along with that is being able to serve individuals in a very in a setting that makes them feel comfortable, that makes them see our passion for serving them. And then at the post-shift debriefing, we then talk about what actually happened during, you know, the clinic itself. Are there certain cases that we felt we could have handled better, and how can we handle that? And so we also use that as a learning tool so that we can sort of continuously improve the quality of services that we provide while, you know, making sure that we adhere to certain important cultural practices.
So we just have a moment left, and I want to give you the opportunity to maybe share something I hadn't thought to ask of you around this work and around the community in at the center, at the Academy of Medical and Public Health Services, that you'd like to share with us.
So I guess I'd like to share two quick stories. The first is we had a elderly gentleman come into our clinic, and he initially wanted just, you know, a basic screening. He really didn't know, you know, what was, if there was any sort of particular health concerns with him. He felt fine. And we quickly discovered that, you know, he had a pretty bad visual acuity. And so, and he actually didn't realize it himself. And so through integrating our clinical services with our social services and working with our partners at Presbyterian and near Presbyterian, we were able to get him completely free corrective lenses. And then he came back to us a couple of weeks later thanking us and telling us, wow, you know, I never realized this, but for the first time in my life, I was able to see my daughter clearly. How powerful is that, right? I mean,
wow.
He didn't even realize that.
Wow.
So that's the first story. And then the second story I wanted to share is a middle-aged female came to us, and she was very stressed out, which is understandable. She was a middle-aged Asian female with three young boys and a single mother. And she was just completely, you know, stressed from figuring out how can she maintain, you know, her family, how can she make an income to support her children. She shared with us over the course of her visit. She originally didn't want to share too much with us. She withheld a lot of information, but then eventually she got more comfortable with us. And she shared with us that for several times, she's actually picked up her three kids and tried to jump into the ocean. She actually tried to commit suicide and, you know, with her three kids together for three times and was unsuccessful. And so what we did was, you know, we created a step-by-step intervention plan for her. We very calmly talked to her and showed her there are a plethora of different resources that are available for her. We're going to help her navigate through each of these resources. We're going to create a step-by-step plan that she can follow easily. And we're going to be there for her every step of the way. We're going to hold her hand through it. And because of that intervention, you know, we were able to save possibly four lives that day from just a simple intervention.
Is she still part of the community?
She actually comes back and visits us. And actually, she comes back and visits us. And last Thanksgiving, she brought a turkey to share with our volunteer family.
Well, thank you for choosing to share two very beautiful and powerful stories with us that are real stories about real people's lives and the way that you, Yuet Chu, who is the founder, president, and CEO of the Academy of Medical and Public Health Services in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, who is a Mahoney Fellow at the New York Academy of Medicine, to every clinical provider and every volunteer at the Academy of Medical and Public Health Services, we thank you. And thank you for sharing the story and sharing the vision of your work with us on HealthCetera.
Thank you so much, Barbara. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Hi, this is Chloe Glickman, and I'm an intern at WBAI. Looking to get professional experience doing something you're actually passionate about? At WBAI, I'm able to develop skills in journalism, marketing, event planning, editing, social networking, and much more, all while working directly with producers and the management team. BAI is always taking applications for credit and non-credit internships, so get in touch today. send an email to internships@wbai.org for more information. Join the team that supplied New York with independent radio for over 50 years. Help keep community radio going strong.
This is Barbara Glickstein for Health Cetera and a news update from the Women's Health Policy Report. On Monday, abortion rights supporters filed 45 amicus briefs urging the Supreme Court to strike down contested provisions in Texas's omnibus anti-abortion rights law known as HB2. According to the Texas Tribune, abortion rights opponents are expected to submit amicus briefs in support of the law within the next few weeks. Here's some background. The Supreme Court will hear arguments in the case on March 2nd, which puts it on track to issue a final ruling in June. HB 2 has already closed about half of the abortion clinics in Texas. The case, Whole Women's Health versus Cole, centers on two provisions. One requires abortion clinics in the state to meet the same building standards as ambulatory surgical centers, and the other requires abortion providers to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. The Center for Reproductive Rights, which is representing the group of abortion providers challenging the law, argues that HB 2 is unconstitutional, creates an undue burden for Texas women who live far away from the nearest clinic, and does not promote the state's interest in improving health. If the court rules for the state, the number of clinics will fall to about 10, compared with about 40 before the law took effect. The amicus briefs refute Texas' argument that HB 2 improves women's health. To humanize the topic, several women shared personal stories of their decision to have an abortion, and the effort to personalize the issue could be particularly important considering Justice Anthony Kennedy's claim in a 2007 ruling upholding a ban on certain type of abortion that, quote, some women come to regret their choice to abort, end quote. In response to that claim, one amicus brief submitted by a group of 10 professional women stated that they, quote, have never regretted their decisions to have an abortion, end quote. The brief continued, to the contrary, the women strongly believe that the right to access an abortion was and is crucial to their and every woman's ability to define their own existence, determine her future, achieve her dreams and aspirations, and be an equal participant in our society. In addition, on behalf of 113 law students and professionals, a brief was filed. And in addition, former Texas Senator Wendy Davis, Democrat of Texas, who sought to block HB 2 with her filibuster when it was initially proposed, signed an amicus brief with other current and former female lawmakers who have shared their personal abortion experiences. Separately, CRR President Nancy Northrup said, quote, individual women have stepped forward not anonymously, but by using their own names. They are fighting the stigma that surrounds the subject of abortion. During a press call, Cecile Richards, president of Planned Parent Federation of America, said the remaining facilities in Texas would not be able to meet demand if the court upholds and contested provisions. She added, Texas paints a grim picture of what will become a reality across the United States if the Supreme Court upholds this clinic shutdown law. Health Senator will continue to inform you on updates on this, and I thank the Women's Health Policy Report for this brief. I'm Barbara Glickstein. This is Health Cetera.
Hi, this is David Amram. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 on your FM dial, and keep on listening.
America's aging population has created a new class of vulnerable older adults, elder orphans. They live alone without support from family or friends. Maybe they never got married or had children. Maybe their spouse and close friends have died. Whatever the reason, nearly a quarter of older adults are isolated, putting them at greater risk for complications from chronic disease, depression, food insecurity, and more.
I've used the term elder orphan because I thought it really described the vulnerability of these individuals.
Maria Carney, Chief of Geriatric and Palliative Medicine at the North Shore LIJ Health System, said an encounter with a 76-year-old man living by himself in Queens spurred her to delve deeper into the issue of elder orphans. HB was admitted to the hospital following a failed suicide attempt. This complicated case was made even more challenging by delirium, unclear decision-making abilities, and lack of social support. His only family was across the country, in California. After treatment, he was discharged to a nursing home for probable long-term placement.
And this individual, for his most of his life, was high-functioning, productive, and independent. And it wasn't until the 2 months prior to the admission into the hospital that it was found that he was losing touch with his relationships, which took some detective work on our part in the hospital to identify who those individuals were and how to find them and reach them.
She presented her findings at a recent meeting of the American Geriatric Society.
We decided when this case, and we've seen others, that we wanted to highlight it and then evaluate this population and see, has this been described? Has it been, what do we know about this population? And how can we potentially intervene earlier? And what we found in our review through U.S. Census, literature review, lay articles, nursing articles, medical literature, is that it is not a documented population. I want to create an awareness. I want to have a call to action. We need to understand, because by our estimates, we expect this population to increase. And currently, I don't know if we are well equipped to plan for this population and handle. We often see them in times of crises and not identifying them earlier. What I realize is we're seeing individuals that are going to tax the healthcare system. And perhaps if we can highlight them earlier and provide resources earlier and help individuals have a plan, we can potentially decrease use of high-cost healthcare and utilize community resources a little better.
These older adults often appear to be doing fine at first.
They may be independent and functioning, and then over time, their abilities decrease, whether it be physical abilities, cognitive or mental abilities, to live independently become harder and harder. And it may be a gradual decline, or there may be a sudden change in their condition. But often, as we get older, we rely on others around us to help us. And these individuals may not have that for various reasons. They may have had it earlier in their lives, and as they get older, they become more isolated, whether it be socially or because physically they can't.
In HB's case, the care team discovered that he had been declining for several months. He was dehydrated, malnourished, and depressed. I asked Carney why no one seemed to notice.
The commonness of depression in the elderly is often diagnosed very late, and yet that's really what seems to have prompted the crisis in this particular case. How can community service organizations or other people that might have contact with older people be on the lookout for signs like that?
Being aware that it's a highly prevalent disorder and a very treatable disorder is one thing. Screening for it, asking about loneliness or isolation is one strategy. But yes, I think it is something we're not recognizing earlier, and we should be aware that it is very treatable. And explaining to individuals, this is a treatable disorder.
We have a burgeoning senior population on the horizon. What is going to happen, especially in a city like New York that already has millions of older adults, if we don't address this issue?
I think we have to really evaluate what our the needs of the baby boom aging population. We need a call to action to create a task force at the health, state department, federal department to really say, what is our most vulnerable population? How are we addressing it now? And how do we need to innovate it or adjust it to properly address the needs? So, for example, this population, the elder orphan population, we don't know their needs. We don't know the description really of this population. Is it individuals that have resources and benefits? Is it individuals that are living in rural, suburban, urban environments? You know, let's analyze it. Let's see. Let's try to measure it and see how, based on that information, their needs, we can make programs to help.
That sounds wonderful in theory, but of course this takes money.
Yes.
How would you tell our lawmakers to prioritize this?
Well, I will say that this is a priority because these individuals are found in times of crisis and they're utilizing high cost hospital care when that potentially could be prevented. So it's a cost savings argument that we could help. Many of these individuals don't necessarily need a hospitalization to care for them. They just need a plan and a support system and to call in those that they know and have relationships with to help.
Carney estimates that roughly 22% of older adults are orphans.
I don't think it's that uncommon, and yet we cannot accurately measure. So all of these are estimates on those that do not have children, do not have families, and estimates of the of who are having children now compared to 10 years ago. But there may be more because the fractioning of families is a factor, and that families are not living near their loved ones always, and that creates a new level of being orphaned.
She says families need to be attuned to warning signs that may signal problems with an aging loved one.
I think they should be maintaining contact, calling, visiting, making sure food is available, making sure they're clean and dressed properly. Are they paying their bills? Are they making their doctor's appointments? Are they falling? Is their care being maintained? Are they independent or are they relying on others or unable to care for themselves? And if that's the case, they may need to intervene in some way. I think many people don't want to ask for help, in my experience, and often intervening a bit to provide some assistance and creating a plan for their care in the long term is necessary.
Carney points out that even if caregivers don't live in the same city, support is available.
So I have patients that have families that are not in the nearby community, and many of them are very creative on use of providing care, having groceries delivered. I have family members that order through the computer grocery deliveries to individuals' homes, access of technology to remind about medication use, and use of communication tools also help. So you can be creative if you're not living in the same environment as your loved one, but keeping a relationship, staying in touch is ultimately the best way.
Even if you're not yet a senior citizen, it's a good idea to begin thinking about those later years.
If you're younger and potentially concerned about being isolated in the future, try to make a plan. Complete advanced directives. Identify a healthcare proxy to help you with your health issues and decision-making. Get power of attorney in place. Create your strategy for yourself. Our geriatric medical group in Great Neck is our outpatient office where we have board-certified geriatricians. We're a multidisciplinary office where we have social work and pharmacy available, and we assess comprehensively individuals and try to work with community resources to help our patients. So whether they live in Queens, Nassau, Suffolk, we are aware of potential services to help individuals. People should not hesitate to pick up the phone. We can help, we can assess, or we can highlight the undiagnosed illnesses Is there an early dementia going on that is contributing to this? Is there a depression that's contributing to this? Are they safe? Can you access an aide to help you? So we can help. Our office is 516-708-2520.
She encourages relatives and friends of older adults to reach out as often as possible.
It's scary when you have a support system. Imagine if you don't have anyone.
Carney wants policymakers and advocacy groups to make this issue a bigger priority. Otherwise, she cautions that more of us are likely to end up as orphans in our later years. For Health Styles, I'm Liz Siegert. We'll be right back.